Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, 6th Canto, Chapter 1, The History of the Life of Ajamila, Text 54. Labdhva namittam avyaktam vyakta vyaktam bhavachyuta yatha yoni yatha bijam svabhavena baliyasa labdhva namittam avyaktam Vyakta vyaktam bhavachyuta. Yatha yoni yatha bijam. Svabhavena baliyasa. Labdhva namittam avyaktam. Vyakta vyaktam bhavachyuta. Yatha yoni yatha bijam svabhavena baliyasa Vaishnavis. Labdhva, having gotten. Nimittam, the cause. Avyaktam, unseen or unknown to the person. Vyakta avyaktam, manifest and unmanifested. Or the gross body and the subtle body. Bhavati, come into being. Uta, certainly. Yatha yoni, exactly like the mother. Yatha bijam, exactly like the father. Sabhavena, by the natural tendency. Baliyasa, which is very powerful. Translation. The fruit of activities a living being performs, whether pious or impious, are the unseen cause for the fulfillment of his desires. This unseen cause is the root for the living entity's different bodies. Because of his intense desire, the living entity takes birth in a particular family and receives a body which is either like that of his mother or like that of his father. The gross and subtle bodies are created according to his desire. Purport. The gross body is a product of the subtle body. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, yam yam bhapi smaran bhavam chajan te kalevaram. tam tam vaiti konteya sadata bhava bhavita. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, that state he will attain without fail. The atmosphere of the subtle body at the time of death is created by the activities of the gross body. Thus, the gross body acts during one's lifetime, and the subtle body acts at the time of death. The subtle body, which is called linga, the body of desire, is the background for the development of a particular type of gross body, which is either like that of one's mother or like that of one's father. According to the Rig Veda, if at the time of sex the secretions of the mother are more profuse than those of the father, the child will receive a female body. And if the secretions of the father are more profuse than that of the mother, the child will receive a male body. These are the subtle laws of nature which act according to the desire of the living entity. If a human being is taught to change his subtle body by developing a consciousness of Krishna at the time of death, the subtle body will create a gross body in which he will be a devotee of Krishna. Or if he is still more perfect, he will not take another material body, but will immediately get a spiritual body and thus return back home, back to Godhead. This is the process of the transmigration of the soul. Therefore, instead of trying to unite human society through pacts for sense gratification that can never be achieved, it is clearly desirable to teach people how to become Krishna conscious and return home, back to Godhead. This is true now and indeed at any time. Om Agena Timurandasya Gyananjana Chalakaya Chakshu Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Kudave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadara Sri Vasudhi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Yesterday we were speaking about the subtle body and its power. We heard how the subtle body is full of intense desires. And as we know from Bhagavad Gita, the subtle body is the template upon which the next gross body develops. So therefore, I was explaining last night, a very nice program we had across the street. The title of the program was Living on a Planet of Uncontrolled Minds. If you want to be appropriately material, you at least have to address the subtle body as the repository of all the material complexities, problems, attempts for happiness and distress. Without any program for rectifying the subtle body, there can be no improvement in the human condition. There's some latest scientific research which is very interesting. Medical scientists have devices for measuring the brain activity, and they have a scale to measure that brain activity, and in that way they posit the presence of consciousness or not, according to their conception. In any case, let's just look at it in terms of brain activity. So they discovered, naturally, when a person dies, the brain activity just goes flat, collapses completely as measured by their devices. That's to be expected. But in the latest research, in like 7 out of 7 cases where the experiment was performed, they found that after the brain activity collapsed completely to zero, and of course the person was pronounced dead, Immediately after that, the brain activity shoots up to 80% for like 60 seconds or 40 seconds. And then, gone. Alternative doctors are saying this could indicate that after death, after so-called what we know as physical death, something is going on. There's a sudden outburst of 80% of brain activity, which means the person is practically, as scientists can posit, fully conscious, basically. Just for like 40 seconds, 60 seconds at the most. Then, again, everything collapses. So, in 7 out of 7 cases, this experiment, I think, was done at a hospital in Los Angeles. 7 out of 7 cases this happened. So they're starting to scratch their heads. What's going on here? When you're dead, you're supposed to be dead. When the brain functions collapse to zero, and everyone can understand, that's it for you, all right. And that's been the standard interpretation. But now, how can you account for the sudden rise again for 40 seconds to where the person is practically fully conscious just for 40 seconds? And then again. These mysteries, of course, are not baffling for us because we understand that the time of death involves the transfer of the subtle body to another gross body. And for most people these days, because unfortunately they're sinful, they have to spend an intermediate time in hellish situations to be trained up to take their next body. I remember on a morning walk with Srila Prabhupada here in Los Angeles, where the question was asked, what will be the destination of most persons in Kali Yuga? And Prabhupada explained that most persons, they're heading into the animal species. These are the hard facts of life. But I've also noticed that the concept of fruit of activity, of karma, is really hard for people to grasp in its full impact and its full implications. We read, the fruit of activities a living being performs, whether pious or impious, are the unseen cause for the fulfillment of his desires. This unseen cause is the root for the living entity's different bodies. So, fruit of activity, karmic activity. How can people apply this principle to their daily life? Because what happens is that people think, my personal desires are one thing and karma is another thing. They externalize karma, that it's something happening out there. And karma refers to really good things you do or really bad things that you do. But the day-to-day desires of the human being, that's just a personal thing. What could be wrong with that? The day-to-day attempts to please yourself, to please others, the day-to-day attempts to make your way through this world, what's wrong with that? So most people, they can't take full on the implications, I've noticed, my travels around the world. They can't feel it full on, the implications of what fruit of activity is. Any attempt to please yourself and please others that doesn't involve first directly pleasing Krishna, going through Krishna, connecting to others, and connecting to yourself through Krishna, this is fruit of activity. So often people react that, oh, this is very severe. I mean, what do you want out of our life? You know, we're just trying to cope. We're just trying to be a little happy. We're just, you know, trying to get by with our friends. And you mean to say that every little thing we do just to improve our situation, or that's karma, fruit of activity, and causes a hard knot in the heart, hridaya grantam? So therefore, we need to repeatedly hear. By repeated hearing and contemplating what you're hearing, the immense reality starts to dawn on you. I remember in 1977, Srila Prabhupada speaking in Mumbai, and he just had given his umpteenth example of how we're not the body. And then he stopped and said, "Do you know why I can always come up with examples like this? Because I'm always thinking about it." And he said, "Well, what is an extraordinary Vaikunthan devotee like Srila Prabhupada? I mean, he's always thinking about how to present to people that you're not the body?" This lesson is crucial. And even when people think they've heard it all before the New Age phenomenon fully hit the Western world, often we Hare Krishnas could catch people by surprise with the talking about reincarnation, talking about karma. We practically had cornered the market. And it's good to make hay while the sun shines. When you see a market niche, you exploit it. But I noticed that since the New Age scene hit, it's basically faded now, but it's permeated into kind of folk beliefs that have spread throughout human society. So when the New Age phenomenon hit, it's like devotees lost their thunder, you know? They can no longer be the ones, the authorities on you're not the body and reincarnation. And so, therefore, I've noticed that devotees started to think that, well, we got to come up with something else other than explaining to people you're not the body, because it's not news anymore. Yeah. Every spiritual person in Southern California, and of course every person in Southern California is spiritual in his own way. So every person in Southern California knows that, you know, you're more than just the body. And everyone's spiritual somehow or other, and everything you do is spiritual, your girlfriend is spiritual. That's the way it is these days. But the actual reality of karmic activity, fruit of activity, still needs to be understood. All right, you understand that there's a subtle body or astral body, as it's sometimes called. But does that person understand? That same person says, "I understand, yes, the mind and transmigration." But do you understand that that subtle body is full of intense desires? And every little thing you do leads to complexities. There's nothing innocent in this world. So this is what people feel uncomfortable about. You're trying to tell me there's no margin for error, there's no innocence, there's no room for just feeling good and having a good time? You're held accountable for every little thing? Oh, this is just too much. Let's look at the example set by Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita. Among many things, Arjuna is teaching us to be concerned with the reactions to your actions. Arjuna is supposed to fight, as you know, but he tells Krishna, sin will overcome us if we engage in this battle. There'll be so many negative reactions. Krishna, shouldn't we be concerned with this? And Arjuna's concerns were justified. He, in terms of a sociological analysis, was super brilliant. This will happen, that'll happen. Families will be destroyed because because the man of the house will be killed on the battlefield. Women will be left without husbands. Irreligiosity will happen. Yajnas will no longer be performed in the home. Arjuna ran down a whole list of the reactions to the action of fighting in the Battle of Kurukshetra. Of course, it was a bit off-center. because, as Krishna reminded him, happy are those Kshatriyas who such fighting opportunities in a cause that is Dharma comes unsought. So either you win and you enjoy the earth, or you die, you go to the heavenly planet. So even on the material platform, Arjuna, there's much more going on than the way you've presented it. And of course, everyone knows that the battle of Kurukshetra was not just some kind of military conflict to get oil or something like that. I remember during the height, it happened early this year, during the height of anxieties about the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. Is it going to work out? Do we have to be there? The media was flooded with information. I saw it in the New York Times. Guess what, Americans? In Afghanistan, there's $1 trillion worth of natural resources. Ooh. Okay, now we understand. Send those boys over there. Maybe we'll get the economy going that way. What to do? You know, we have to get the economy going because it's our role in life to increase our prosperity. And therefore, economic development is an utmost necessity. There are even arguments by economists that economic development, economic expansion is a moral necessity. Because when people have money, they behave better and they're more open-minded. Therefore, let the economy constantly expand, and then the good qualities, the Dharma, will constantly expand. But when there's not enough money going around, when there's not enough economic expansion, people become very miserly. They don't give to charitable causes. They start thinking bad of the immigrants and the foreigners and all these kind of things. So all that can be solved just by economic increase. So, the reactions to fruitive activity. We were speaking last night on our program. We showed briefly a minute and a half multimedia presentation about how, if the well-known fact, if everyone in the world lived according to the North American standard in terms of ecological footprint, you'd need 5 planet Earths. Now, I could understand the reaction to that information, depending on where in the world I speak. If I speak about that in New Zealand, rated by the UN as the world's most ecologically conscious country, the people, oh yeah, those Americans. Of course, if I speak about it in North America, Canada, or the USA, it is kind of a moment of silence. Yeah, we know that, but look, we're just trying to live a nice life. What's the big deal? We're trying to make our way through life. Give us a break, you know. You got to be happy some kind of way. Half of all marriages end in divorce. There's more children living with just one of their biological parents than those children living with both biological parents. You know, so why not just try to consume in a nice way? You have to, somehow or other, feel good about yourself and feel good about this world. All right, if everyone did what we did in terms of ecological impact on the Earth planet, yes, we know you need 5 planet Earths. But at the same time, look, life is short. There's got to be another way to deal with this situation. There has to be another way. Remember Prahlad Maharaj's statement that the remedy causes more complications than the original problem. That reminded me of something else, example I start to use, that the ecological do-gooders in North America, and certainly they have a legitimate problem to deal with, and it has to be dealt with, they were feeling good that through legislation and popular pressure, we've drastically reduced the number of the burning of coal in the U.S. and the number of coal-burning power plants. It's on the wane. People are getting the point. that this is disturbing the environment. It's polluting. It's causing global warming. People are getting the point. Look at the statistics. In the U.S., there's been a rapid crash in the number of coal-burning plants established. Colombia used to be a big coal exporting nation, but then the U.S. market dried up, and so the Colombian coal exporting business went flat. But then what happened? Is there a material solution? Remember the example of transferring the burden from one shoulder to another, and you think that's progress? The same burden remains? Now, half of all the world's coal production goes to China. And so, what's going on in America, Canada, Colombia, Australia, all the big coal-producing countries, due to environmental pressure from activists, due to pressure of environmental activism, and also some realization that, hey, this is screwing up our country, they are no longer burning coal in their own country, but they're shipping it over to China. And what does that mean? It means not only is the same Earth planet just getting it from another place, but the problem worsens because of all the ecological impact caused by the ships burning fuel to transport all the coal to China. So it gets worse. And then when the businesses are asked, why are you doing this? They say, look, you know, we have to make money. That's the purpose of business. And remember, coal mines are labor intensive. There'll be jobs in your community. Who's going to argue against jobs in a recession? So, well, as for the earth and the environment, well, we have to have some leeway. We need to understand that we still have to live our life. So this is the human tendency to rationalize and try to cause some kind of, try to construct some kind of bubble around yourself, because after all, you're a nice person and your friends are nice, your relatives are nice, and so I think nature can't be so stringent. This chapter of Bhagavatam is presenting a very stringent reality. Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita was referring to a very stringent reality. Krishna, we can't do this. Think of the sinful reactions. Of course, he's talking to Dharma personified, as if Krishna doesn't understand these things. And it's true that Arjuna's presentation was a bit off the mark, as Krishna briefly explained to him, you know, even on the material platform, this is Dharma. What to speak of on the spiritual platform? I want this. After the battle of Kurukshetra, you have Krishna departing Hastinapur for Dwarka. He's heard Queen Kunti's beautiful prayers, and he responds just by smiling, an enchanting smile. He's about to leave, and then Yudhisthira stops him. My dear Krishna, please stay a few days longer. And because of Yudhisthira's love, Krishna agrees to stay. Yudhisthira, as we all remember, this very poignant part of the Bhagavatam, Yudhisthira is able to delay the departure of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yudhisthira has something on his mind. I have done something that cannot be remedied even if I spend millions of years in hell. I have caused such havoc in the world just so I can be the ruler. I've caused extraordinary problems to families, to women, to children. All that just for my selfish desire. Even if I spend millions and billions of years in hell, nothing will atone, Nothing will cleanse away these reactions. He also brought up the point, even if I do material welfare work, still, it's not enough. Not even an Ashrameda Yajna, it's not enough to rectify the karmic reactions for what I've done. Hriti Rudam Dratmana. Look at my heart. Look at the sinful activity and reactions manifest in my heart. Dratmana, my heart is so hard. Just take a look. Hriti Rudam Dratmana. Very lucid self-analysis. Of course, Yudhisthira's lamentation was arranged by Krishna, just like Arjuna's falling into illusion was arranged by Krishna, to set an example. Take the reactions to your activities very seriously. So if Yudhisthira didn't give himself any margin for error, he didn't put a bubble around himself, he wanted to face the situation square on. I did actions. I'm the cause of the reactions. What is the hope for me? If someone as righteous as Yudhisthira does that, what to speak of the so-called innocent people of human society today? There is no bubble. There is no margin of error. And this is a little uncomfortable for people to understand. But when they read Bhagavatam and then their hearts become touched by the very emotional responses based on knowledge of Yudhisthira and others. Of course, we know that Krishna purposely arranged the situation that even he and Vyasadeva could not pacify Yudhisthira. Even historical examples were given, Shastra was given, but by Krishna's arrangement, Yudhisthira, his discontent, his inner turmoil was not quelled. Therefore, they went to see Bhishmadeva, lying on the famous bed of arrows. Actually, Bhishmadeva could have left long before this, but he maintained his life just to see the Pandavas assume their rightful throne. So he died a happy man. As you know, he could die at will. So he prolonged his stay in this world just to see the grand outcome. But in Yudhisthira's eyes, the grand outcome was not grand at all. How can I feel good about being king? And Shonaka Rishi, in speaking to Sutta Goswami at Naimisharanya, he brings out this point in the Bhagavatam. He asks directly, how could Yudhisthira feel at ease assuming the throne, knowing all the total devastation that's hit the world? I mean, according to Mahabharata, 640 million soldiers died. World War I, 17 million casualties. World War II, 54 million. But 640 million? Prabhupada refers to it as the greatest military conflict of the past 5,000 years. Naturally, just like at one of our programs a couple of nights ago, that one was entitled Gratitude, a Material Illusion or a Spiritual Necessity. And as always, a person asked the question, the Battle of Kurukshetra, I mean, isn't it about like this inner struggle between good and evil, and Arjuna represents this and the Kauravas represent that, and so the battle is actually simply something going on in the heart. This is why we need devotees like our Jhuta Karma Prabhu to put holes in the present theory of human antiquity. Because people are always going to bring this up. Where are the traces of such a battle? And 5,000 years ago? I mean, really? We don't see it. As the Pandavas and Krishna approached Bhishma Dev, the scene was so emotionally intense. A happy man about to die, and Yudhisthira overwhelmed with grief at what he had done. And Krishna, wanting Bhishma Dev to be glorified, just see, Bhishma Dev can do something I can't do. He's going to give knowledge to Yudhisthira. I want to glorify my devotee. My devotee does more than me. That is Krishna's desire. When we consider the mind and the effect karmic activity has on it, we start to see the calamitous situation. Lord Rishabhdev, in speaking to his sons, says, karmatmaka, when the mind engages in karmic activity, it becomes colored. That's nothing innocent. It becomes tinged. And the result of that tinge is that the person starts to desire material elevation. So this whole idea of I've got to better myself materially in life, I've got to make the world a better place, I've got to make my circumstances better, this comes from a karmatmika mind. These desires are the natural result of a mind that's tinged by karmic activity. So we have to learn how to trace things to the root and find the cause. At the end of this purport, we read that, therefore, instead of trying to unite human society through pacts for sense gratification that can never be achieved, it is clearly desirable to teach people how to become Krishna conscious and return home back to Godhead. This is true now and indeed at any time. Our acharyas are quite heavy on material welfare work. It's not simply Srila Prabhupada. He's getting it from Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, who you can read in the memoirs of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur that he viewed material welfare work as a deception. When speaking to great material welfare workers who would come see him in India, first Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, as you read in the Harmonist newspaper, he would first say, what you're doing is noble, what you're doing is high, but then he would rip the whole thing to pieces. Why is there a problem? You're deceiving people. By putting the emphasis on material welfare work, you're distracting them from theism. So you're building up false expectations. And as a result, people aren't able to focus on what is actually the way to change things. So you're being deceitful. You're inspiring hope in blowing on the boil. That example Prabhupada would give comes from Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. You have a boil and you're going to get relief by blowing on it. You can try. You probably don't get boils, but you may get mosquito bites from time to time. Just try blowing on it and see if it relieves the itch. I've tried it. There's like a very slight soothing sensation. Now, you're going to make a big thing out of that? So Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur's point was, blowing on the boil doesn't work. You need the expert words of a devotee which lance the boil. He always got right to the point. Lance the boil and all the pus comes out, and then you have solved the problem because of the expert words of the devotee who can explain what exactly is going on in terms of karmic activity. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur gave the example of emptying out the ocean. You can get millions of people to try to solve the problem if there's an ocean by emptying it out. Even if they can do it, what will be the result? He explained, they just transfer the water somewhere else. So this is cheating. You think you've made progress. The ocean is now empty. But where did the water go? You just shifted it to another place. And you're giving yourself credit for helping and uplifting. Just like we explained about the coal burning. It doesn't go on in first world countries like USA, Australia, Canada. But they just take the coal and they ship it to China, which burns that coal and it goes into the atmosphere of the Earth planet. So they've just shifted the burden to another place. And of course, people in the exporting countries are making money, jobs are created, the president might get off the hook, and, and this is why life goes on in this world. Or does it go on? So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur was very strict about material welfare work. Yet, surprisingly, the harmonist reveals, at the same time, he would criticize householders who would not do anything for poor people. And he would explain the mentality of such householders he was criticizing. He criticized everyone. He's a Vaikuntha man. He knows what the real standard is. He said, aha, so you're thinking you can't give any money to these beggars because you're saving it for your puja, eh? Well, what about that puja at your home? How potent is it really? It would just get under everyone's skin. So actually, by your not giving anything to distress people, your heart becomes hard, and therefore your imaginary puja at home to Radha and Krishna becomes affected. How could he say like this? He was speaking from the platform of Varnashram Dharma, in which householders especially are supposed to not only look out for their own family members, but see all of humanity as family members, all creatures. So this was Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur's point. He said, you'll take care of your family members even if they're not devotees. So why can't you look at the whole world as your family and give a little bit? This is there in 7th Canto, in the chapter Ideal Family Life. And Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur himself and his sannyasis, they would give a few pennies to beggars. So it's interesting that while so thoroughly condemning material welfare work, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, from a Varnashram Dharma point of view, said that householders have the responsibility. He said, not everything, but a little bit, in recognition of the principle that we're not, that the householder ashram is not a miserly ashram. It's an expansive ashram for showing compassion and charity. And that way the heart becomes softer and the puja can be better. Very interesting. Sometimes in his explaining the uselessness of material welfare work, he would say, I know this sounds sectarian. I know this is going to be hard to accept, especially by atheists. But he would stick to his point that even from the viewpoint of solving material problems, material welfare work doesn't work. What to speak of getting to the root of all problems. So this is our Sampradaya. It's very interesting how Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur stuck to these principles, yet at the same time he had an expansive vision in terms of how those principles are applied. He was famous for distributing huge amounts of prasad to the poor people in Calcutta. And of course, while they were taking the prasad, they would be involved in some devotional activity, some chanting. And as we said, he encouraged householders, give a little bit, in recognition of the principle that a householder should care for everyone, not simply family members, but see all creatures as family members. Well, this is indeed very interesting. Finally, one last point. the hope for making the world a better place, making our life better. It seems, again, an innocent thing. Hope. How can you live without hope? I was talking to Dr. Nanda, asking him about what's going on in the cancer scene, because he has a cancer clinic. And he was saying, you know, cancer is normal these days. It's nothing like unusual. It's just part of normal life. So I said, well, have there been any great scientific breakthroughs in dealing with cancer? He said, yes. Instead of people dying in 6 months, they die after 2 years. But he said that with measured compassion and empathy. He said, people want to have hope. And so if a doctor can just help them prolong their life 2 years, they feel good and they're willing to spend huge sums of money. And what is the kind of hope that they have that drives them onward? I just want to live 2 more years to see my son or my grandson graduate from school. I just want to hang on just for another year to see my grandchild born. Or I just want to hang on for another year and a half so my daughter marries the guy she's living with. I just want to see that, and then I'll go. So he said the progress, the medical progress, has been in extending life for some more months. And this hope is so important to people. So that's why people may feel a little agitated when we explain to them about there's no innocence in fruitive activity. There's no margin for error or margin for feeling good about yourself that will protect you from the reactions of the network of karma. Hope is also very important in bhakti. Asha Bandha. It's there in Nectar Devotion. I don't have any love for Krishna. I have no love for the or attraction for the causes for developing love of Krishna. I'm not from a good family. My background is simple. Yet and still, hope against hope, one day Gopi Janavallabha will be merciful upon me. So that hope is substantial. And that hope is purifying and it's uplifting. So it's not that Vaishnavas are against hope. We just want our hope energies to properly, to be aimed properly. And of course, as every devotee knows, as the years go by, Krishna more than fulfills your hopes. We'll stop here. And yes, quick question.
Thank you, Maharaj. When you were speaking about how devotees used to be the soul-selling agents of the topics of reincarnation...
I didn't say soul-selling. I said they had cornered the market.
That's what I mean. And they're no longer. What market are the Chaitanya Vaishnavas expert in and always will be and always will be able to emphasize in that? What direction should therefore be taken in that direction in terms of preaching?
Right now, as far as I can see, it's bhakti. And then that, once the world catches on to that more and more, it'll be pure bhakti. We don't have the metaphysical novelty that we used to have. Have you heard of reincarnation? No, we'll take a look at this. Yeah, everyone's, oh, reincarnation, yeah, you know. I think in my past life I was a movie star, and that's why I like movies in this life. And that's what it is. So, there's so much similarity between the metaphysical knowledge of Vaishnavism with impersonalism. But once you get beyond liberation from material existence, that's when bhakti really takes off. We'll grab our market share any way we can. As Prabhupada explained, Krishna's devotees are the greatest opportunists. So if it's not this, it'll be that. Okay. So ask, Prabhu.
Thank you for a wonderful class, Maharaj. When you were speaking about Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj, there's something that I read a while back, which is quite interesting. In his field of preaching, he started a festival program. And in that festival program, it traveled throughout India, but it was actually a carnival. It's described that he had people that were swallowing swords. Mm-hmm. He would have the local up-to-beat, up-timeline musicians come.
Yes,
you know, and
yes.
they weren't necessarily all just, you know, mm-hmm. Hare Krishna. It was mm-hmm. the up-to-date, mm-hmm. you know, tabla mm-hmm. player mm-hmm. or sitar player, yeah. musician, musical. Yeah. And this carnival, and he had toy rides and all kinds of things to attract the public. And what's that? A Ferris wheel, even. Uh-huh. You would even have Ferris uh-huh. wheels just to attract the public in order to get them just to come.
Yeah.
And after they would come, then from there he would take them on this journey of understanding Krishna consciousness. So maybe the Krishna conscious movement should think a little bit like in those terms of utilizing what's popular in society and attracting the innocent and then giving them an opportunity to hear about Krishna consciousness. And we see that he was very successful with that.
Getting ideas for the next Rath Yatra?
Yeah, I was thinking about having a tilt-a-whirl and a Ferris wheel for the kids.
I'm sure that as devotees, as your good self, as they continue to increase in their purity, they'll have the counterbalance in order to keep those things in proper perspective. But naturally, when devotees are a little young, they're a bit squeamish and, ooh, this is Maya, ooh. And that's good. But we don't want to kind of eternally lock ourselves in a box. We don't want to be stereotyped. At the same time, we want to maintain the purity. So certainly Los Angeles has such senior venerable Vaishnavas that you could keep something like that on track. Thank you. Glory to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.